Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Judea Pearl, ACM Turing Award recipient in 2012. And this award is really the sort of the Nobel Prize of Computing. Now, Judea is a legendary pioneer and world-renowned distinguished researcher and professor at UCLA. Judea, wow, you just have an amazing background and with a lifetime of outstanding research contributions, just influencing so many diverse domains and with such lasting global significant impact. And we're really privileged to have you come in today. So thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, insights, and wisdom with our audience.
Well, thank you, Steve, for having me, and be glad to share whatever I know with the audience.
So, Judea, when did you hear of this extraordinary honor and really, as I mentioned, the recipient of what is widely considered the Nobel Prize in Computing, and this is the 2011 ACM Turing Award, and then how did you feel at the time, and what was the reaction from your colleagues and your family?
Well, I believe I heard about it on the phone in the beginning of March, and to tell you the truth, I first thought it's a prank call from some Irish lottery, and I was about to tell them to put me on a do not call list. But my wife was on the phone. She said, what kind of a world? And when she mentioned Turing, then I realized, yes, that I may be on the list there. And I was very happy that the committee considered me. I was also partly surprised because I do not see myself a member of the mainstream computer industry. But at the same time, my colleagues, when they heard about it, they all came up with the reaction, what took them so long? So I was sort of a combination of pleasure and surprise. Because my main focus of research is not considered mainstream computer science. It's not aimed to make a computer more powerful or more accessible, but it has a focus on artificial intelligence, which is sort of, a foster daughter of computer science. And my focus is also on a cognitive science and on empirical sciences, which are at the periphery of computer science. So I was happy to see this jury or award committee appreciate the impact of my work on both the AI and our peripheral field around computer science.
So what was the reaction of your colleagues and from your family?
Well, my family had a mixed reaction. My daughter asked, are you finally famous? Or how is our life going to change? And questions of that sort. But I assure them that nothing is going to change. I'm going to remain the same daddy. And the award is just going to give me additional recognition and perhaps exposure so that my work will be appreciated and I'll have a greater facility, say a wider stage to propagate the ideas that I've been working for so long on. I think I pacified them.
Well, you definitely will get a wider stage in which to be recognized because of the stature of this award. Now, to the next question, what specific challenges in your education in Israel were catalysts or inflection points in your lifetime of contribution, and how and why did this happen?
You know, I never thought that my education was unique, that my upbringing was in any way special. But in retrospect, now that people keep on asking me about it, in retrospect, I do think it was unique and special. First, I was lucky to have giants for teachers. My teachers were all professors, academicians that came to Israel from Germany. They taught in academia in Heidelberg, in Berlin, and they had to leave their positions and to take on a high school teaching position. And my generation was lucky enough to benefit from their expertise and their knowledge and grew up in such an atmosphere of challenge, of scientific challenge. And they were really polyglots in the sense that each one of them could teach geography, history, math, and science at the same time without notes. And we were exposed to it by chance. And that had a great impact on, I think, on my education. All this is, I'm speaking in retrospect. At the time, I didn't realize that other educational systems do not have this luxury or that privilege. And the second aspect of it, which was unique, was that my education was embedded in an overarching cultural renaissance of nation building, with total commitment of the entire society to excellence and collective ideals. Everything was in the making. All molds are to be broken, and the future is what we make out of it. So evidently this spirit percolated into science education. I remember one of my math teachers always gave us the feeling that you too can make an original contribution to math. You too can find an original proof of Pythagoras' theorem, for example. A proof that one that has never been thought of before. Or a new slant on Newtonian mechanics. One that Newton perhaps has neglected to consider. He even had a seminar in the summertime on his own time with a few kids enticing them for original work in mathematics. And the same thing applies to college. We had great teachers that always spoke as if they were present at the time of the discovery. And they made the discovery vivid, historically, in historical context, and vivid to our mind. And we were spoiled enough to assume that we need to understand the lectures in real time. That's something which I had not seen at UCLA in my teaching. In American education, students are more or less passive. They do not interact in real time with the professor. They tell themselves, it's okay if I don't understand the lecture in a moment. I'll take the time in the afternoon to go over the notes and perhaps I'll understand later. This is not unheard of in Israel. You got to understand in real time. If you don't understand, you let the teacher know, either by raising your hand or moving your chair or resorting to other kind of mischievous activities. Understanding in real time was considered to be done. So I was lucky in that sense. And also I should say that I'm lucky that higher education in Israel did not suffer, though I took my college education during the time of austerity. We shouldn't forget that in the 1950s, Israel tripled its population threefold, from 600,000 to 1.8 million, and no one went hungry, and higher education did not suffer any budget cut, and that was due to great vision of the leadership, who understand that if you build a nation, scientific excellence is a prerequisite, and we were simply the beneficiary of that, vision and leadership. So I'm constantly reminding myself and my audience that I owe a lot of what I've done to my education and to the spirit of nation building in Israel.
Yeah, that's a really interesting perspective, and you talk about the fact that at that time, even though it was the early days and it was a time of austerity, there was no budget cuts, and there was passion in the classroom and excitement and interaction. How do you propose this, how would you contrast that with the current education system in the United States?
I think it has to be revamped. And one of my pitches is that mathematics and science in general ought to be taught in the way it was discovered, in historical context, not hierarchical in terms of the logic of that subject matter, but in the way it was discovered, with the scientist's picture on the wall, even the scientist family on the wall. I'm not kidding, because this is part of the context of the discovery. Archimedes in the bathtub, that's important. And that gives students the idea that science is not a dry subject, but it's a human subject. It's a description. It's part of the struggle of the human mind with the mysteries of nature. And that means that the student becomes an agent.
And I guess you would have that same sort of feeling about budgets. You would definitely want to ensure the education system in your current country, and that is the U.S., is that budgets are increased, I guess. Right?
But it's not only budget. It's good teaching. It's teaching from the heart. combined with budget. Because budget only enables you to train and to attract good teachers.
Now, I asked you about some of the aspects of your education in Israel and how they were catalysts or inflection points in your lifetime. Now, let's apply that same question to your work at RCA and then your move into academia. I mean, how did your work there become catalysts for inflection points in your lifetime and contributions, and how and why did this happen?
Well, my first job was in RCA Research Laboratories in Princeton, New Jersey, and during the 60s, that was my first exposure to computer science or to computers, and everybody was ecstatic by the potential growth of the field. Everything was new. Every phenomena in physics you can think of were thought to have a potential to become the future technology for computers. And so everyone understood that the days of vacuum tubes and even the transistors are numbered, and we're looking for new phenomena, new physical devices, new physical phenomena to implement computation. Memories were the stumbling block. At that time, we used magnetic core memories, which were donuts that literally thousands of girls around the globe from Hong Kong to Massachusetts had to string one by one, crisscross and diagonal. And everyone knew that the days of core memories numbered, and people worked all kind of phenomena. Some worked on new magnetic configurations, and some worked on photochromic memories. And I worked on superconductivity, because in superconductivity, you can store information in the form of permanent current going around like vortices without needing to string them. And that was an exciting time. I remember our supervisor, at least once a week, he would get into the office and say, "Well, do you have a new patent disclosure?" The whole atmosphere was rushing and chasing after new patent devices. And however, eventually all these activities came to a halt because semiconductors took over. And everyone who worked on memory devices had to find new jobs. And nothing remained of my PhD dissertation, which had to do with superconducting vortices, except for one piece of analysis which I did, which recently I noticed a physicist, without my knowing, called the Perls vortex, and it gave me an instant claim on immortality. But at the time, I had to find a new job, and I went to academia. It was easy then to go from industry to academia because industry looked down at academia. Nothing of importance came out of academia. The transistor and the laser were all invented in industry. So I was accepted to UCLA as a memory expert, but there was no activity in memories or in the entire computer field. On memory devices, everything went toward the semiconductor memories. And that activity was taking place primarily in industry. Fairchild Camera was the pioneer at the time. So I went to work on things which interested me privately for a long time, namely emulating myself. And that's something which I think every computer scientist is curious about, more so than psychologists, because computer scientists do have the means to emulate themselves. And I started working on pattern recognition and various aspects of vision, but eventually I ended up with heuristic search and probabilistic reason, causality, and so forth, and I got into artificial intelligence research.
You know, you've made so many contributions, so how has your work specifically and lastingly contributed to, and there's various components here, things like machine reasoning and natural language processing, computer vision, robotics, computational biology, econometrics, cognitive science, statistics, philosophy, psychology, epidemiology, and the social sciences?
Well, the list may give an impression that I'm expert in all these fields, which would be wrong. But if you notice, all these fields that you mentioned have one thing in common, and this is uncertainty. They are embedded in uncertain and noisy data, and they all need to have principles of filtering out the noise and extracting out meaning. This is where my work on uncertainty comes in, and I should then divide it into several categories. I believed for a long time that probability is a dominant formula for handling uncertainty, and at the time they were contenders to probability theory. I'm talking about the time in the earlier days of artificial intelligence, especially the early days where experts came into being, and what people used to do is take the deterministic rule-based systems and decorate them with uncertainty or degrees of belief. If you have a rule, for instance, that if you have a high fever, that you're likely to have malaria, a rule like that would be quantified with a certain degree of strength. And then these degrees of strength would interact when you have a large expert system of many rules until you get the right answer, which solidifies and condenses the uncertainty is given to all the rules in some mysterious way which was not clear to even to the programmers. And the question, at that time, I strongly believe that when you use probability theory, you are guaranteed to have intuitively acceptable answer to your question. Because in textbook probability, you rarely get a surprise. You rarely get a paradoxical result. There are some paradoxical cases in probability theory, but very few. Most of the time, if you put in the right data, if you put in the right rules and knowledge, then you expect to have an intuitively acceptable or plausible answer. So I ask myself if probability is a protector of plausibility, let's put it onto a computer. The problem was only that even if you have a few variables, the amount of storage that you need to invest to encode a probability function for 10 variables, it goes exponentially. And the question was, if we do it probabilistically, how come computers cannot do it probabilistically? And if we do it, despite the fact that it calls for exponential storage, it means that some approximation is feasible. So from the fact that we find probabilistic answer to be plausible and we do things fast and reliably, we have a proof that approximation is feasible. And if approximation is feasible, let's put the approximation on a computer. And I looked for a long time for such an approximation. Then it became clear that if you break down the problem into loosely coupled subproblems, you can get parsimonious encoding of probability knowledge, and you can get a tractable algorithm for processing it and for updating it. And you also get a way of debugging it. Namely, if things don't go according to expectation, you can find out which rule is the culprit and debug. This combination of tractability, storage economy, and reconfigurability, that was exactly what is needed to make to change expert systems from rule-based to probabilistic. And at the same time, it gives us something which is very called for by cognitive observation, cognitive science observation. They explain how people are able to read a text fast, park their cars reliably, and perform operations in an environment which is constantly bombarded with noise and erratic phenomena and partial knowledge, and do it so reliably and swiftly. So it gave us an idea of how people do things, and it also gave us the hope of being able to do it distributedly. And distributedly is important because it's hard to believe that in our mind we have a graph supervisor, namely an algorithm that tells each neuron when to fire. Evidently, neurons are firing in response to their neighboring neurons, to the firing in their neighboring neurons. And things are done asynchronously, autonomously. Each neuron can wake up in the middle of the night and decide, I want to fire now. And the system should be able to accept, to propagate all these firings and reach a certain equilibrium, at the end of which each concept is given the correct degree of belief that is dictated by what? By probability theory. Otherwise, it wouldn't be plausible. That gave us the impetus, drive, to look for a structure that could enable to propagate belief asynchronously. We first went into trees and polytrees and then other structures, but eventually there was a dilemma. What do you do when you have loop and and you have a continuous propagation that does not convert, and does not convert, and if it converts perhaps to the wrong answer. Things of that nature kept on creeping in this work, and eventually, out of desperation, I suggested that the mind probably neglect the presence of loop and instruct each neuron or each module or each variable to be activated and to send messages as if it was part of a singly connected network, namely as if it was part of a loopless network. And that worked miraculously well. It changed the whole ballgame and produced results that are much faster than what one would theoretically anticipate. And it became a tool, a software tool for anybody who is dealing with uncertainty to be able to update belief in response to observation and in response to different knowledge, to updated knowledge, and get the correct beliefs within reasonable times and using reasonable amount of storage. So that explains why the beneficiaries of these techniques are so widely spread, from machine learning to natural language processing, vision, robotics, and so on. All these areas must deal with noisy environment, noisy observation, noisy data. The second step which one should single out is the work on causality, which was my second transition. I left probability theory and I went to causality because I realized that people do not store knowledge in the form of probabilistic relationship, but in the form of cause-effect relationship, and that all these probabilities, propagation and so on, and all the beliefs, all the algorithms that we invented for belief propagation are just surface phenomena, and they come from cause-effect relation. So I shifted totally from probability to causality. And the two, by the way, do not mix. They have a different language. Like the saying goes that correlation does not imply causation. And that is revealed in the language that one needs to use to handle these two fields of relationship. The hardest thing for me at that time was to quit probability as a language. Let's talk about computer language, okay? To quit probability as the oracle of knowledge and to move to a new language, which is a cause-effect language, when we deal with causality, when we deal with intervention, when we deal with action. That was a real, I think, traumatic shift for me, and not only for me, it still remains a traumatic transformation for most scientists, because we all take statistics 101 and probability 101, and we are led to believe that if you had probabilistic knowledge, then all the answers in the world, all the questions in the world will be answered. This is simply wrong. Causality demands a language of its own. And once you realize that, then as a computer scientist, you can invent a language. If you don't find it in the literature, you invent. We take linguistic shift from one language to another with a smile, with grace. And most scientists take such a shift to be traumatic or impossible. I mean, I keep on saying that people go to war for language more than for the content of the language. Anyhow, we are talking about causality now. So the areas of robotics, the areas of cognitive science, definitely need an understanding of how people process cause-effect relationship. If you want your robot to be able to handle an uncertain environment and things don't go according to anticipation, like if the robot spills the milk or breaks the glass, then that robot needs to be able to repair the environment, and such repair can only be done if robots understand the cause-effect relation in that environment. So the question comes, how does robot learn cause-effect relationship, and how the robot then utilizes that relationship once it is learned or once it is even taught by the program? It's not an easy task because the rule of cause-effect are not logical rules. It's a new calculus, a different kind of calculus, an ordinary logical implication. So that is exciting. We do things in our minds and we don't have a calculus for doing it. This is a dilemma which is enticing to every computer scientist, I think. At least it was for me. So I spent a lot of time trying to formulate such a calculus that will enable us to handle actions and observations and come up with a correct answer to a question, for example, what will happen if I intervene. So once we understand why it is important for cognitive science and why it is important for robots, we can also understand why it is important for all the empirical scientists that are working day and night around computer science. And I'm talking here about economists. I'm talking about statisticians. I'm talking about psychologists, epidemiologists, and social scientists. And these are hardworking people spending millions and billions of dollars on randomized experiments, trying to figure out if a drug has beneficial effect on society or adverse effect, and trying to find out what will happen if you reduce class sizes, what will be the quality of education. All this requires careful experiments, and a lot of money is spent on that. And this, they are all immersed in a noisy environment, tons of data, and they can be likened to the robot in the middle of a kitchen or laboratory trying to make sense of the signals he or she receives. So I liken them, all these hundreds of thousands of empirical scientists, to a colony of robots. From a cognitive viewpoint, they are facing exactly the problem that a robot is facing in a new and uncertain environment. And they do not have the principles for handling that environment. They are simply working with traditional probability and statistics, and these languages are not satisfying their needs. So I was lucky, and we were lucky, that the effort we spent on trying to equip robots with the capability of reasoning with cause and effect enabled us to unveil the principle by which human science should analyze cause-effect relationships. And we were able to equip them with a powerful calculus for doing that. And that was important because throughout my research in robot understanding, I had the support of hundreds of thousands of customers in the peripheral field of empirical scientists who were thirsty for any new trick, any new algorithm, any new innovation in the study of cause-effect relations. And that explains, I think, why the work that I'm doing happened to be applicable to so many fields. We are dealing here with the basic of reasoning under uncertainty and under cause-effect relationship.
And then I guess the causation kind of research that you did really ties into philosophy itself, right?
It tied to philosophy because philosophers for a long time tried to explicate what cause-effect is. And it's actually it's a nice story that most of philosophers who dealt with this question refer to counterfactuals as the basis for explicating cause-effect. Hume, for instance, in the 18th century, defined cause as in terms of counterfactual. A would call, is said to be cause B if B would not occur had A not occurred. So he went backward in reason against, backward in time, counterfactually. We know that A and B did occur. When do I say that A is the cause of B? If B would not have occurred had A not occurred. So you see, here you have a giant of philosophy, a pillar of philosophy, explicating cause in terms of counterfactual. And the same thing with David Lewis, which is a modern philosopher, also basing cause-effect on counterfactual. And the question is, why did they explain causation in terms of counterfactual and not the other way around? It must be that counterfactuals are more cognitively plausible, more less problematic, more deeply entrenched in our intuition, which means that people can process counterfactuals more swiftly and reliably and consistently than they can process cause-effect relations. Wow, if this is the case, then why shouldn't we equip machines with counterfactual reasoning? And why shouldn't we base causal reasoning in machine on the basis of counterfactual knowledge? And indeed, I believe today, and I realize through my research, that counterfactuals are the building block of scientific thinking. There couldn't be any science without counterfactual. The whole physics is one big series of counterfactual reasoning. The equations of physics are not algebraic equations, they're counterfactual equations. If I give you a simple rule, if the weight is, let's say, Hooke's law, Okay, the length of the spring is proportional to the weight that you hang on it. It operates under any weight. In addition to the current weight, which happened to be 1 kilogram, the law tells you what will happen if the weight was 2 kilograms and 3 kilograms, which means every physical equation that we find in high school physics really stands for a collection of counterfactual statements. If the current would be 3 ampere, the voltage will be that much. Every law in physics can be interpreted counterfactually. And the conclusion is that we need to build a calculus for counterfactuals. And the also conclusion is that if you encode counterfactuals in the form of a physical equation, here I'm talking about structural equation. First of all, there is a dilemma. How can we, human beings, communicate with counterfactual and understand each other so reliably and so consistent, and we form a consensus? For instance, if I tell you that if Oswald did not kill Kennedy, then someone else did, you say, yes, that makes sense. And if I tell you that had Oxford not killed Kennedy, then someone else would have, you say, I'm not too sure. I don't think so. And this is uniformly understood by people in our society, and we form a consensus about counterfactual things, even if we reason backward to Julius Caesar. We can think counterfactually what will happen had he not crossed the Rubicon. That's how we teach history. And we understand each other. And if we do, which means that we have a counterfactual machinery in our mind, and we store knowledge in such a form that it enables the machinery to operate and delivers answers and draw conclusions swiftly and reliably. Now, if this is the case, then we should do the same to machines. We should be able to. And the fact that we have a existence proof in the human skull gives you the encouragement to commit yourself to a piece of research and believe that it's gonna be success. It must be success. In the case of counterfactual, I'm very satisfied with the result that we have. We do understand counterfactual today, and we have been successful in algorithmatizing, of reducing counterfactual reasoning to algorithm. And that has a tremendous ramification both for robot and for empirical science, because then we can answer questions, for instance, about credit and blame. For instance, is this employer guilty of sex discrimination in hiring? And this is a counterfactual, which means had he not discriminated, this lady would have been hired. There are many cases in the law which are defined counterfactually, and a lot of questions in the empirical side have a counterfactual flavor. And so I'm very happy with the level of understanding that has been reached now, and again, reached by what? By an attempt to equip robots with such capability. The beneficiaries are all the empirical sciences that rely on counterfactual thinking, and they all do.
Can you additionally profile your extensive research history, their lasting impact, and some valuable lessons you wish to share from each of your top research areas?
Valuable lessons. I can summarize my valuable lessons in 3 sentences. First, people reason with probabilities. And second, people do not reason with probabilities, but people reason with cause-effect relationship. The third is that people do not reason with cause-effect relationship. They reason with counterfact. So here you have the 3 sentences of the major impact and lasting impact of my research. The impact itself is in the algorithm that were developed to encode this relationship, to produce new inferences from observations and from knowledge. So, but one should classify the impact of my work into 3 layers, probability, causality, and counterfactual.
I can see how your progression in your work and your research, and as you gained insights and your insights evolved, that became the major inflection point in your life, but also the major reflection points in your field as well.
It has had impact on the field. It has given researchers in AI the comfort and the confidence that they can encode knowledge in this form and can perform inferences on that knowledge. And also it has a tremendous impact, as I explained, on the peripheral field. One area, for instance, which benefited immensely, one question that has been lingering on for generations without any even attempt to a solution is a question of external validity. Let me explain. You conduct experiment in a laboratory and you assume that the results will be applicable to outside the laboratory, to the field, to the population. A robot is being trained in a simulating environment. You expect the robot to apply what it learned in the simulation room outside, in the field. Okay. So, under what condition can we extrapolate from the environment in which we were trained and we learned into a new environment, which differs from the first in several aspects? Even if you know the aspect which makes the two environments similar and different, how would you transfer the knowledge? And this is has been unsolved problem, first posed by empirical scientists. It's called external validity. Others called it extrapolability, generalizability, and other names, but it hasn't been solved, not even touched. And we found a complete solution for that problem, which means that if you are able to encode the aspect of the two environments that you believe are common and those that you believe are different, and you tell us the list of differences and commonalities, we are able to tell you whether a certain relationship that was learned in the experimental environment is transferable with all the knowledge, all the external knowledge that you can have, into the new environment where you cannot conduct any experiment, but you have to apply the knowledge that you learned in your training. Oh, that is, I am very excited about it. It's some new result, and I'm waiting for all the social scientists and economists and, epidemiologists to jump in glee and to rejoice into this discovery. Well, it's a year already. They haven't jumped and they haven't danced, but I have patience, and I know that one day they will. So this is an example of a problem that was handled well with the, by virtue of what? By virtue of our ability to take an unformulated question, an unformulated system of relationship, and submit it into a formalism and draw the conclusion and algorithmatize it. And the same goes to, the application for robotics is also clear. If we can handle counterfactuals, then we can handle retrospective and introspective thinking, and we can equip robot with what we call free will and responsibility. And that will be a great advantage for robotics and for human-machine interaction, because you and I communicate under the assumption that there is free will, and we transfer knowledge with that assumption. So we make each other do things with that assumption, and that will, equipping robots with such an illusion will improve the communication between man and machine. And will also teach us a lot about our cognitive system, what makes us obtain, under what condition we have the illusion that we act out of free will, and when do we have a different sensation that we act involuntarily. And we also be able to answer the question of what we gain by this communication language. How would the soccer team of robots play better, equipped with that facility, as opposed to the way robots communicate today, without the facility to assume a social responsibility? These are all partly philosophical, partly psychological, but mostly engineering problems. And that is the nice thing about it, that we take philosophical loose problems, fuzzy problems, speculative problems, and we reduce it into engineering problems. And when we assume engineering content, you cannot fool things. You cannot snow people. You get to show performance. And then you harness logic and the principle of computer science, semantics, and syntactic, and you demonstrate performance.
You know, you mentioned this whole concept of robotics, and it's clear that, or at least it's clear to me from your discussion there, that you do believe that we will have robots where free will can be developed, because it's really an illusion, and you can sort of engineer that illusion using counterfactual. Is some of that work being done then at some of the laboratories around the world that use your research and encode it within a robot?
In a certain way, you can say it's done everywhere. You can say, for instance, that the robot that plays chess, is reasoning counterfactually because it investigates a variety of moves. So it looks at several moves and chooses the one that looks best according to a certain criterion. But because it did explore other avenues, you can say it, in some loose and superficial way, reasoned counterfactually. And when you ask the question, would robot have be able to be equipped with free will, one could argue that any chess-playing machine already has free will. Otherwise, it wouldn't have chosen the move that it chose. Now, that's a superficial way. But it's a very deep philosophical question now. Under what condition can we say that the robot has free will? It's like a mini Turing test, a Turing test for free will. When we talk about human being, the argument goes immediately philosophical. Whether we have illusion of free will or truly have free will. Okay? Most scientists that I talk to believe that we have that the free will is an illusion. Okay? Some believe that it's not an illusion, but relies on all kind of mysterious phenomena such as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. Who knows? Fractals, everything that they can hang on to, you know, can explain how we have this strange sensation that we have an option to do one thing or not to do it. At the same time, we have this very clear sensation that they can do or not do a certain action, when in fact we do not have this option. We are going to act one way or the other depending on how the neurons are firing at any given time. So there's a conflict here. When we talk about human beings, the conversation immediately becomes philosophical and unmanageable. But when you talk about a robot, it becomes clear because no one would claim that robot has free will. So then the question is, can we equip robot with free will? It becomes an engineering problem. Under what condition would you not be able to? You would not be able to distinguish between a robot or an organism that has free will and one that does not, like current day robot. I think the solution lies in making robot that can explicitly speak about his or her will. Like, why did you want to do that? And once the robot is equipped with that ability, then you wouldn't be able to distinguish. And according to the Turing test, a robot that acts as though it has a free will does have a free will. That's not a question anymore. And with that comes, for instance, social responsibility, social adaptation, and agency. That all comes with the idea that in communication through credit and blame. One robot should be able to tell another, you acted wrongly, and you should be blamed, you should be put out of our team. You caused us to lose the game. And the other robot, the blamed one, should be able to take that communication and translate it into a reconfiguration of its software. That would be then the proof that the robot has free will, and he or she understands the meaning of credit and blame.
No, it's interesting. You know, earlier you talked about this whole idea of external validation of validity. Is that really where your current research is focused? In other words, can you define what will be the outcomes of your current research and their application?
I cannot define. I can only hope that it will lead to a more friendly conversation between men and machine. It will lead to a more effective communication among robots when it comes to issues such as social good, collective aspirations, all these concepts that move us into action. If we can have transfer them to robot communities, that will be a great achievement in terms of the ease with which we can communicate with robots, because we are social animals. And in order to communicate with robots, we have to be able to equip robots with understanding of social interaction. And this counterfactuals is a basic building block in social interaction. So this is one aspect where I see the result of this research developing into a useful software. The external validity, that will happen not in the robot world, but in the empirical side. And of course, it will affect machine learning. Because within machine learning, you don't want to relearn things as you move from one environment to another. You want to use all the aspects of the training environment that are shared by the new environment and just learn the novelty in the new environment. Otherwise, relearning everything from scratch is a lost cause, is a losing game. And that's where external validity comes into game. So it will improve machine learning tremendously. I don't know how at the moment, but I just know that it will.
But it's clear that from the applications of external validity, and really it hasn't been taken up as broadly as it should be or where it's going, but that could lead to a Nobel Prize in economics.
No, the econometrician that I know are very conservative. They are the last one to utilize something that they can benefit from. So I think it will take care. It will be picked up by machine learning first and then transferred by osmosis to more conservative circles, among them social science, economics, health research. That brings us to the question of how the Turing Award may help me propagate the ideas into neighboring fields. So I'm extremely hopeful that the new stage that I have now will enable, and the new microphone will enable me to propagate this idea to people who can immediately benefit from it. Robotic people will benefit from them in 10, 15 years once we have community of robots playing soccer. Not today, but the people who are dealing with economic research, people dealing with epidemiology, people dealing with education research and psychology, people can benefit tomorrow. So this is one hope that I have for the spreading of these ideas.
Interesting. So what are your most difficult challenges in research, and what valuable lessons do you wish to share from these challenges?
Well, my greatest challenge was the transformation from one language to another, from probability to a causal and from causal to counterfactual. And I know that if I have to teach young people from my experience, the thing that I would encourage them most would be to have a flexibility for shifting language. I found these to be the hardest obstacles in my research. They were the hardest obstacle to overcome in my research. I see them being the hardest obstacle to overcome among my colleagues, especially the non-computer science colleagues. And I wish we could revamp education to the extent where growing scientists will have the flexibility to shift from one language to another.
How do you create that ability to shift from one language to another?
I think by demonstrating that you cannot solve certain class of problems within one language, and you can solve them easy with another one, and demonstrate the ease of transformation. You equip a language with one or two new operations, with one or two more algorithms for handling the new operation, and zoop, all the questions that you couldn't answer in the first language are answerable swiftly and reliably. That has been the greatest pleasure that I drew from my research. And I believe it can be transferred to students in every field. That is coupled with the idea that that you can tackle an area which is black box, that you have no prior knowledge about. And once you have the right language, the light shines, and you are able to handle difficult questions with the new tools. That has been the greatest pleasure that I drew from my research, being able to do intellectually today something which I couldn't do simply by learning another trick or another operator. That is a tremendous pleasure. It's like growing up again. You can do things today that you couldn't do yesterday. By doing, I mean not just multiplying larger numbers. I mean tackling questions that you didn't know how to even approach. You can tackle them today with ease and comfort and smile. That is the greatest pleasure I drew for my research. And I saw it happening. Questions I couldn't even begin to approach became easily solvable once I got through a certain transformation.
I can see that your work and external validity and people accepting that work and shifting to this, all the possibilities that this enables, but there's always this idea of groupthink where people are resistant to change. What do you think that's so?
Well, it has many components. I focused on the transformation from one language to another. Indeed, you know, language is the greatest guardian of dogmatism, a propagator of dogmatism. People learn languages only in their childhood, and then they cannot shift. And that happens in science, too. When you learn one language, it's hard for you to shift, and you get into this cult, really a cult, of believing that if you only knew, if you only were able to express the knowledge that you have in the language that you have, then you will be able to solve things, given that the language you have is incapable of expressing what you wanted to express. That, I can see it again and again among my friends in, for instance, in econometrics, economists, for instance. If you look today into the definition of econometric model on Wikipedia, you can find there a definition which is simply wrong and reflects exactly what we were talking about. The inability of econometricians to understand that economical relationships cannot be expressed in the language of statistics. The definition they give for econometric model is it's a statistical model which captures economic relations, which is just damn wrong. It is not statistical model. It goes beyond statistics. You cannot express with statistics the content of economic model, like the effect of, let's say, duties on price. You cannot express it in the language of statistics because it has to do with the word effect. Effect is cause-effect relation. And statistics is incapable of expressing things like as simple things as the rooster crow does not cause the sun to rise. It's impossible to express that in the language of statistics. And econometricians have not learned it, have not be able to liberate themselves from this dogmatic language to believe that statistics can answer all their questions. This is an example of conservatism that is induced by sticking to a language, but inability to change. I give an example. Plus, there is also inertia in education and in the research community, in, politics, the politics surrounding transformation of paradigms. People have power over other people and influence other people to use one vocabulary as opposed to another in order to propagate their ideas or to resist other ideas from spoiling the youth. So, but I think the main one is the ability to liberate yourself from the constraints of language.
You know, we're discussing some of the challenges in terms of, you know, transitioning from one kind of language to another kind of language and opening up a whole bunch of possibilities. Can you describe other areas which you may consider controversial or where there's much discussion in the areas that you research?
I can discuss. There is a great controversy now in statistics whether counterfactual reasoning is beneficial. Counterfactuals, you cannot measure counterfactuals. You cannot refute counterfactual state because it is introspective about things that didn't happen. What would have happened had I not done what I actually did? So there is a question, a philosophical question and a great controversy whether statisticians should resort to such a language. Again, I'm talking about the language. But for them, it's not a matter of language. It's a matter of scientific true and false. If you cannot test something, that it is meaningless. And if it is meaningless, then it might lead to erroneous results without your knowing. That is one controversy which I'm immersed in. I do not believe in that, by the way. For instance, we have many things in mathematics which are fiction of our imagination. Complex numbers, to mention an example, or even negative numbers are not observable. They are only placeholders for some arithmetic operation in our mind or in our algorithm. And so coming from this viewpoint, I am for using in ordinary research and ordinary inferences concepts which are not directly testable, which are testable only indirectly in terms of the results which they produce. And if the results can be proven to be always in conformity with things that we do measure, then we shouldn't hesitate to resort to such fictitious entities as that mathematics endows us with. And counterfactual are such entities. Very useful and highly controversial.
I guess another area would be, you know, this whole idea of religion and religious myths being metaphors or poetry for genuine ideas. ideas that are difficult to express. Do you want to talk about that at all? Or?
Yeah, I think many scientists get irritated by religious talk, given that they are atheists and they do not believe in a deity or in a life after death or in supervision over one's action. They get irritated when people do communicate in such a language, like interreligious, interfaith dialogue, which are truly meaningless if you are a dogmatist atheist. I'm an atheist. I don't believe in life after death, and I don't believe in higher supervision over one's action. But at the same time, as a computer scientist, it behooves me to translate human communication into an algorithmically meaningful context. And I find the communication among believers to be meaningful. It's loaded with metaphors, such as you'll be punished, you will be burned for in hell, you're condemned, you'll be redeemed, you'll be, and so on. It's on one level, it's meaningless. If you don't believe in life after death, what does it mean? You believe redeemed, or you accept Jesus, or you whatever. It doesn't make, but at an algorithmic level, it makes a lot of sense. When you, it's a metaphor for some punishment that is realizable, if not in after death, it's realizable as a collective in the course of history. The whole idea of ethics means that you are subjecting your instant gratification into a higher good, and higher good means into a collective good in the long run. So from historical perspective, all this religious metaphor makes sense. God will punish you makes terrific sense. If you replace the word God with the word history, suddenly the whole Bible makes sense, which means in the long run, history will punish you, which means if your evil deed will be picked up by young people and they will perpetuate your evil behavior, eventually society will suffer, history will suffer, then you as a member of the collective will suffer in the long run. Now, God will punish you, not make perfect sense. So if you interpret metaphors, religious metaphors, in this context, I open the radio and I listen to an evangelist preacher and he makes perfect sense to me. Even though I'm atheist, I'm Jewish, but I understand him perfectly. And that gives me some, power in communicating with people from different faiths. I don't laugh at what they say. I respect what they say because I translate them to a new computer language and I understand the meaning of what they're trying to convey. It's as simple as that. So the question comes, of course, should we equip robots with religion? I don't know the answer. It would be a nice experiment to see if a community of robots becomes more friendly, more socially responsible, once we equip them with the illusion that there is a deity that overlooks their deeds and their thoughts and takes record. I don't know. They may become vicious, like some of the religious cults, or they may become socially exemplary social animals. I don't know the answer. The only experiment we have is experiment with human beings, and we are still debating whether it was successful or not.
Judea, you've laid many of the foundational pillars as one of the top groundbreaking visionary innovators, and distilling from your experiences, what are the greater burning challenges and research problems for today's youth to solve, to inspire them to get into computing?
I think the greatest advice I could give to youth would be to listen to their intuition and to listen to their century-old curiosity to understand themselves. And this is, I believe, a driving force behind most computer scientists, an urge to emulate yourself. Well, first it's an urge to understand yourself. But today we learn that understanding implies ability to emulate. When you emulate, you can take things apart and you understand. And understanding means being able to take things apart or to predict behavior under the conditions when things are taken apart. So I would just advise them to listen to their intuitive drive to understand themselves and not to take no for an answer, because every aspect of human behavior that is not yet but can be implemented on a machine is a PhD thesis and deserves a PhD thesis. So I would just advise them to follow their natural intuition in terms of understanding themselves.
You know, to our youth again, with an interest in the future of computing, but without the educational foundation, how would you explain your work in probability, causation, the calculus of intervention, Bayesian networks, and counterfactual?
Oh, this is really easy. I just need about 10 minutes in front of a student, and I can explain it. So everybody understands that things are uncertain in the world. Okay? There are all kinds of noises. You make estimation, and the things don't turn out what you expected. That's uncertainty. Okay? We humans are able to handle that fairly well. We cross the road, and we don't get hit by a car, even though our estimate of the distance of the car wasn't very accurate. And in everyday activity, we are bombarded with random phenomena, and we are able to manage. The question is, how can computer manage the same degree of uncertainty? And we learn in school that computers works by ones and zeros, truth and false. How do you equip machine with the degree of the shades of belief, the shades of likelihood? This is the work on probability. It's one layer. Easy explain. When students try to emulate it with the three variables, they get a great kick from seeing that the computers can produce results which are plausible. Give them a simple detective story, like for instance Watson and Sherlock Holmes and Watson. I have it in my book that Holmes got a phone call from the neighbor saying that he heard a burglar alarm, and Watson is worried that burglary took place, and then he listened to the radio and find that the earthquake took place, and he wondered whether it was the burglar alarm was triggered by a burglary or from an earthquake, and so on and so on. You give him a story like that, and he said, okay, encode the story on a computer and have the computer answer a few reasonable questions, such as, would the radio announced about earthquake reduce or increase the probability that a burglary took place in Watson's apartment? And the computer answered nicely. It reduced it by 20%, which makes sense, because if you explain one cause, you take away belief from the other cause. It makes sense. So students, even not computer scientists, get tremendous kick from seeing their knowledge emulated and amplified by the computer. And then they get, they appreciate the difficulty of encoding more than 3-4 variables. You very quickly run into exponential exclusion, and they appreciate the ability to accommodate thousands of variables. Then comes the question of cause and effect. If you just ask him to encode a simple sentence which I mentioned before, that the rooster crow does not cause the sun to rise, okay, they appreciate the difficulties of encoding cause-effect relationship. You cannot encode it with the languages that students in any of the sciences have been trained. It's undoable. And so when you pose to them the same problem, encode the story about the Watson and Sherlock Holmes on the computer and answer a few questions, but now the questions are going to be more sophisticated, such as, what will happen if Watson decides to do something and to, for instance, play a prank call to Sherlock Holmes and tell him a certain joke? Namely, if you ask a question that involves intervention, action, they cannot do it with the available machinery that they have. And they get a tremendous kick from being able to do it once you show them how to encode the idea of action. Do X, raise taxes, make me laugh. So these are actions that can be encoded nicely on a computer. And you ask a simple question, what will happen if I do? Or what will happen if I do things after I observe something? And you get the right answer. What do I mean by right? One that matches our intuitive expectations. Students have a tremendous pleasure from playing this game. And they also get appreciation for the kind of, for the general strategy of taking an area that has not been encoded before and encoding it and seeing how your intuition gets amplified by formal language and formal algorithm. This amplification is, I think, it's universally appealing to all students, to all young people. regardless of whether they are in computer science or outside computer science.
So upon reflection, what specific qualities make you excel and why?
I'm the last one to answer this question, aren't I? I think the answer should be I'm lazy. I'm lazy and lazy. Lazy means that I cannot think very deeply, and I would like to have a pocket calculator that can think for me, and I found one. So this desire to transfer my thought due to laziness to a machine that can do things for me. You talk about quality. It's a quality that that haunts me throughout my life, being lazy. At the same time, I should say hard work, hard work, hard work. So I can give you two answers. Lazy, 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 and hard work, hard work, hard work.
That's interesting. Now, looking at your past, present, and maybe into the future, name three or more who inspire you, and why is this so?
You mean people, right?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be people.
Oh, inspire me. But to tell the truth, I was very influenced by stories about great science. I was. I did run out of the bathtub together with our comedian screaming, "Eureka, Eureka." I did. And I climbed with Galileo on the Tower of Pisa and insisted to see the two rocks falling. And I did dance with Faraday. I did. When the two magnets started rotating, when he made the first rotating machine. So I think stories about great scientists did influence me a lot. And present-day scientists, if I were to choose, would be Boole and Shannon. Boole because he took, he translated logic, which before him was not a symbolic province. It was done in the mind, and he reduced it to a symbolic approach. So in that way, he played the same game that I was talking earlier about, taking a phenomenon, formalizing it, and enjoying seeing your intuition amplified by the game of symbols. And then Shannon followed Boole, and he translated, he took Boolean algebra in his master's thesis in 1938, and he just noticed that you can use Boolean algebra to optimize Boolean function on switching set for telephone exchange. That was, for me, it was one of the greatest inventions of the 20th century. You take an abstract symbolic language done by a mathematician in 1850s, I believe. Oh, no, sorry, 1847. I have Boole's original manuscript, so I know 1847. And you apply it to a new phenomena, totally new, relay network. And it started essentially computer science. I was talking about the same sort of intuition, seeing one's intuition amplified through formal math, which overrides my entire research. So that's why I would choose Boole and Shannon as my heroes. But of course, I would always enjoy Einstein and his humor and his humanity and his insights. And Einstein identified the discovery of Galileo and the discovery you can infer cause-effect relationship by experiment to be one of the two greatest achievements of Western civilization, or Western science. The first he attributed to the Greek philosopher for inventing the idea of proof in geometry. And the second was Galileo's discovery that with experiment you can verify cause-effect relationship. I think Einstein is one of my heroes, of course. And I think the field is ready for a third revolution. And this is putting the two together, putting experimental science under the auspices of the Greek mathematician, namely under the formal guardship of logic and formal math.
Today, you continue to make significant historical contributions. How will your growing status contribute to your vision for the world, society, industry, academia, and technology?
This is dangerous, really, because when you have a greater notoriety, or you call it status, people expect you to say something smart and wise on every topic. And I resist it. I should resist it because I do not have anything wise to say in every topic. For example, I refuse to comment on singularity. At the same time, I do have some wisdom in areas that are not usually represented in computer science. For instance, I would try my best to revamp statistical education in this country, as well as science education. Science, as I told you before, should be taught as a game between men and nature. And in social science, too, I do have a humble opinion about how the media distorts cause-effect relationship. And I could utilize my expertise in this area. I generally decline from commenting on fields in which I really do not have expertise.
This is a bit open-ended. You choose the topic area. What do you see as the top challenges facing us today, and how do you propose they be solved?
Education, education, and education. It includes science education. It includes social education. For instance, we need to teach pride in the exceptionalism of Western civilization. At the same time, we should teach the kinship of all mankind. So it's very hard, but it's doable to teach together the dignity of being different and the sanctity of being one. And I know it's doable because my education was that kind, and I think it can be perpetuated to the next generation. I see it being eroded, and I hope it can be restored.
It occurs to me that you see human beings in terms of how we do things, and you've given sort of a representation of how that can be sort of emulated or produced in a robot, and giving the illusion perhaps of free will or maybe of consciousness. And human beings are able to manifest all of this in great leaps in technology and thinking and so on. How come we don't see that in other species? How come we didn't see that historically in the Neanderthal?
I didn't get the question. Didn't see what in the Neanderthal?
Well, I would assume, though, that, you know, humans have this sort of processing of counterfactuals. It's innately ingrained in our machinery. And you've been able to create a representation of this so that it can be also produced in a robot or in a computer.
Yes.
How come that machinery that we have, and we share much of the genetic code with our ancestor or with a cousin, the Neanderthal, or with a relative, again, a chimpanzee, for example, how come we don't get the same kind of outcomes from those other species or predecessors and so on?
Well, I think that this really, it was a cultural revolution at certain point, which gave rise to a counterfactual thinking in men and society. I do not have the data. I do not have the knowledge. I try to get some linguists to enlighten me in this direction, to tell me whether the history of language shows us that the acquisition of counterfactual vocabulary was accompanied with a certain cultural development, with a quantum jump in the cultural development, for instance, with the development of tools. I wouldn't be surprised if the linguistic analysis indicates that the two phenomena occur together, the ability to reason counterfactually and the development of tools. I'm not sure. I've looked at certain ancient languages, but I couldn't find any analysis on this transition. I only remember that in the Bible, God does not talk counterfactually. Only men talks counterfactually. God asked Adam in the Garden of Eden, "Did you eat from the tree that I told you not to eat from?" He did not ask for why did you do it. He asked for the fact. It's only later. Abraham was the first person in the Bible who talks counterfactually when he comes to God and says, "You are going to destroy the city of Sodom and Gomorrah? Are you going to wipe out the righteous together with the wicked? You can't do that. What if there were 50 righteous people in the city?" So here he used the first time in the Bible is used counterfactually. What if there were 50 righteous people in the city? Now, this is a dilemma. What is Abraham trying to ask God? Whether he can count properly? He doubts God's ability to distinguish between the wicked and the righteous? Or regard God's ability to count the people? No, I think the idea is that Abraham was after a generic rule. When would a city be destroyed despite the fact that it has this X number of righteous people? This generic rule is the rule of collective punishment. which is applicable not only to the particular city under consideration, but to every other city, to every other community. So in this way, Abraham was the first scientist who searched for the generic rule behind the phenomenon. When did science develop? We cannot say that the Neanderthal man was a scientist. It has the capability to reason scientifically about phenomena, to seek the generic rule behind behavior or behind the environment. That took place, or at least that was embedded in the language much later. I'm looking for this transition. I don't know the answer. Perhaps this broadcast will reach the ears of some linguist or history of linguistics or history of language development and will entice their curiosity to look into that question.
Perhaps then it's tied to something like the FOX2P gene, which enables speech in the way we have it as human beings, or maybe it has to do something with social learning and the fact that our children learn from us and they can pass that down through generation to generation.
Perhaps, but I think it has to do with credit and blame. You punish your child if the child does something wrong and you expect him to correct behavior. Dogs can do it too, but not at a linguistic level. If the child asks you, what have I done wrong? You spilled the milk on the carpet. And the child said, I didn't mean to. Well, next time you become more careful. This kind of conversation doesn't go between monkeys.
Okay, so again, maybe the root is the FOX2P gene that enables this kind of linguistic manipulation that only humans can do. And that then enables maybe social learning in the context that we're talking about as well. So, and that social learning being through counterfactual. This final question is about your aspirations with the Daniel Pearl Foundation. So perhaps you can give a bit of history and then answer aspirations for that foundation.
Well, the tragedy had driven us to take an action, to utilize all the emotion and goodwill that the tragedy had evoked and channel them to one cause, one aim. This is to roll back the culture of hate, the ideology of terror that took Danny's life. And we are trying to master all the leverage that we have in various communities to accomplish that. And we have a great leverage because the image of Daniel Pearl is immediately recognizable. We've learned in all over the world. And when you have such an image that immediately evokes the willingness to act, you can rally people to do good things. So we are focusing on three areas. This is the journalism, music, and dialogue. We bring journalists from Muslim-majority countries to the United States to train them in atmosphere of free press and to absorb the dynamic of American style of journalism with the hope that they will go back to their countries and start similar and germinate similar activities. And we see great success for that. And if you take if you believe in the saying that investing in one journalist is investing in 100,000 and sometimes a million readers, you can see the leverage that we have here through the investment in journalism exchange. And the other avenue is the music. Danny was a musician. He always carried his violin or mandolin with him in his travels, and he always made friends through music. And he inspired musicians around the world to express themselves and to use their artistry to mobilize people for this cause. So we organized hundreds and thousands of concerts on his birthday. In the month of October, you'll see 2,080 concerts were organized in the past October in 84 countries, including Iran and Saudi Arabia, and to move people towards understanding of tolerance and humanity. The concert may last only 1 hour, but it leaves a visit if the music is played under the dedicated to those ideals. It does leave a residue, and we believe that it accumulates. A residue accumulates and makes people more willing to act in that direction. And the third avenue is the dialogue. I did take upon myself partnership with a Muslim leader, Muslim scholar, who is the chair of Islamic studies in American University, and we travel from city to city and we represent the sentiments of our respective communities. I represent the Jewish community and he represents the Muslim community. And we express our grievances and express sentiments and try to discover areas of common ground. And with the hope that such dialogue will continue in the community in which we pass. And they did. And I think we have great satisfaction from showing people that dialogue between faith are feasible and can be conducted by two grandfathers, you know, in a cordial, friendly way, with respect and with understanding. That's our third avenue. And of course, we have also a series of lectures and others, but this is the main three pillars through which we try to propagate the idea to roll back the culture of hatred.
Today, you have a lifetime of outstanding research contributions and influencing diverse domains and with lasting, significant global impact, and you've taken the time to share your time, your passion, your history, your success, and all of your experiences through a very, very long, globally impacting lifetime of just doing it and making a difference. And I really do thank you and appreciate you coming in today to do this interview and to share all of that wisdom with our audience.
Thank you, Steve. It's really a privilege for me to share my little knowledge with your audience, and I hope it will be useful.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Jadea Pearl, ACM Turing Award recipient in 2012, which is widely thought of as the Nobel Prize of Computing. Jadea is a legendary pioneer, world-renowned, distinguished researcher and professor at UCLA.